Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for tuning in to The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Wednesday, January 28th. This morning, Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke is in the studio with us to talk about the digital divide. The state has received millions in federal funding to boost internet connectivity. We talk about what the broadband money will do across Hawaii. We learn about why Queens Health Systems is pushing back against a deal between the state's largest health insurer and Hawaii Pacific Health. We also revisit the roots of Queens Hospital. In today's Manu Minute, we meet a bird who lives under the cloak of darkness, and we take you to London, where earlier this month, an exhibit about Hawaii opened to rave reviews at the British Museum. Never before seen artifacts on display for the world to see. Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. With so many headlines about federal funding cuts, a bright spot emerged on the scene last week. It had to do with Hawaii receiving $149 million in what's called BEAD money. It stands for Broadband Equity Access and Deployment. It's funding to help boost high-speed internet in underserved and unserved communities. Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke has been tasked with rolling out the Connect Kako initiative, as well as Ready Keiki to help with preschool education. She joins us live this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's really nice to see you again.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah. And so, you know, I have to ask, we have this money in hand already, right?
No, absolutely. And that's the good part. And we've been waiting for a long, long time, whether it was the BEAD funding, which is basically the broadband funding that will go out to the communities, and or the infrastructure money, we were able to retain, you know, we were able to get this from the federal government. In this day and age, you never know. Things are being cut left and right. The University of Hawaii is always on edge because, you know, they wake up and they hear additional grants being cut. There are many programs throughout the state, especially in our Department of Human Services or SNAP or whatever it is. You know, we're always watching, okay, are there programs being cut? So we're very happy that after a long negotiation and back and forth that our University of Hawaii under our Connect Kako initiative was able to draw down and be awarded $149 million.
Well, I had some concern because I know the President Trump did come out and say that he might pull back some of that money from states if they try and pass legislation that slows down artificial intelligence and its development. So I don't know. Are we worried about that? I have no idea what state lawmakers are proposing this session.
Yeah. And, you know, you think about it. AI is here to stay. There's a lot of fear about AI. But, you know, I mean, we are, even when we're doing our speeches or when we're writing stuff, or inquiring on the internet, we often use ChatGPT or now you're using Gemini. AI is not something that can be restricted or stopped. So I think what the Trump administration, what they do is they want to just say stuff, and sometimes you got to make sense of it, whether it's makes sense or not. In this situation, the University of Hawaii, under our Connect Kako initiative, work really hard working with NTIA under the Department of Commerce to get this funding. And what this funding is, we were one of the first 18 states and territories to be able to get this funding. There are a bunch of states who are still working with the federal government to secure the funding. So I think that tells you something about how tight this plan was, how well our team worked with the federal government, how the federal government had confidence that our plan in deploying internet service throughout our communities was a good plan, and we're able to do it.
And the connectivity also relies on undersea cables, right? Because we're an island state, and some of that money is going to go toward developing that.
Absolutely. When we talk about Connect Kako, we launched Connect Kako in November of 2023. And the whole idea behind Connect Kako is coming out of COVID. We realized that high-speed, reliable internet service is not something, you know, it's just nice to have. It was a necessity because people had to do online work. People had to do online schooling. They even had to do telehealth. And nowadays, you know, I mean, for even for my doctors, I'm sure, Catherine, you too, we continue to do online health and telehealth, and even many of government services are transitioning to online services. Right. So it's really important that we have high speed internet service.
Yeah, I mean, we saw that. Yeah, with the pandemic, you know, what a lesson that was. And so, yeah, I mean, some of this money then is going to go to help with redundancy and expanding access.
Yes. So when we look at the Connect Kako initiative and what reliable internet service mean for the state of Hawaii. The state of Hawaii, our island state, is the most isolated landmass in the world. And sometimes that's to our disadvantage, but as far as the internet service and broadband is concerned, we are, because of our geographic location, we are at an advantage because a lot of the cable, you know, people think they have a phone, they have a laptop, and somehow internet mysteriously come and appear on your phone or your internet. The way that internet works is it's connected. We are connected to the rest of the world through these undersea cable. And when we take a look at these undersea cable, it's pretty amazing because that's how we connect to the continental US. That's how we connect to Asia. That's how we connect to New Zealand and other countries. And because of the initiatives, because of this Connect Kako initiative and the state along with the federal government working together to ensure resiliency and redundancy and bringing connection to our residents, that groups like Google has committed to bringing more lines, more resilient lines, and that's very exciting. The Google effort is trying to connect many of the Pacific Island nations. And for instance, a nation like Tuvalu has never really had strong internet service. And for the first time, they are going to have internet service. And when you look at all the connections through the Pacific Islands, and when you look at all the connections through all some of these island states that, or islands and nations that never had internet service, it's like bringing many of these countries to the next century. So it's very exciting. And the fact that Hawaii is playing a crucial role in becoming that conduit, connecting many of these countries from east to west and west to north, it's a very exciting time. So they are making a significant amount of investment. The state of Hawaii, in addition to the $149 million, we also already receive over $100 million from the federal government to connect between the islands because these Google lines or other trans-Pacific lines might land in the state of Hawaii, but it's still our responsibility to connect the islands. And the last thing we want is if you, no matter where you are, in Hanalei or Hilo, if your internet service goes out, you may not be able to get your telehealth services. You may not be able to do some of the online services that you're used to. And you think, oh, when does your internet ever go out? Well, it did happen in 2019. The residents of Kauai
That's right. I remember that. Left without internet.
And can you imagine how devastated that was for these individuals who maybe their telehealth appointment got cut or they were on a online or whatever services that they were using, it was cut. And thanks to Hawaiian Telcom, they were able to repair it very quickly. But, you know, you look at that and you go, wow, you know, we depend so much. And these making sure that our island is connected to the world, but we are connected to each other makes a huge difference.
And I know University of Hawaii, right, that's a priority of the president. You know, I know Wendy is just... they've just come out, you know, very clearly that we need to move in this direction. And you've got them working on that piece.
Yeah. So the University of Hawaii is having dual roles. So they are working with ocean networks to connect all the islands to provide resilient lines between the islands. They are also charged with receiving this new funding, which is the 149 BEAD funding. The 149 BEAD funding is connecting, now that we're connected to the world through Google and many other private groups. And then the University of Hawaii is connecting the islands, working with ocean networks. Now, how do we get those lines to the communities? There are communities like Hana. There's communities, you know, even Na'alehu, going down to Na'alehu. There are huge spots, even driving out to Kona. There are huge spots of time where you don't get any signal. All you see is this satellite thing, and your phone tells you point in the air and match up the satellite, yes. And that doesn't work. And if you think about, if we want to ensure that we are serving the entire state, that's what BEAD funding is. We are going to use the $149 million to connect 7,000 unserved communities in the state.
Yeah, no, it's a big ask and a big task. I do want to spend some time talking about the efforts with Ready Keiki, the preschool, because we had Senate President Ron Kochi, and he had talked about, you were on his island recently looking at what we can do, because that's the smallest, you know, island, yeah. and they need help.
Yeah, you know, we are very excited to announce that as of coming August, 6 out of the 9 elementary schools on Kauai will have a preschool program. And that is amazing. And if you think about Kauai, we are going to use Kauai as an example or as a test model for the rest of the state. This past few months, we celebrated opening our 100 free preschool statewide. And so we have in Pauilo, we have in even East Molokai, we're opening a bunch of preschools where there are no private providers. And many of these preschools, it's so exciting to see, because you go and visit the classroom and, you know, these kids are listening, they're enjoying. Every single one of them, I ask them, do you love school? And all their hands go up. And it's just such a joy to see. And in addition to that, there are 4 Hawaiian immersion classrooms. And you go in the classroom and they are speaking all Olelo Hawaii.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you know, they can speak in English, and kids are just speaking in our native language. And just to see that, it just makes me feel like, okay, we're serving our purpose. You know, we're serving the purpose of providing not just quality educational tool, but it's giving them the opportunities that, you know, maybe our past kids didn't have. And so it's just between our broadband initiative and the Ready Keiki initiative, these are fundamental, foundational things that 20 years down the line, we're going to look back and go, wow, you know, we were able to accomplish so much during this time. So I just feel so pleased with my team, so grateful for all the state departments, all the partners, all the counties who have helped get to this point.
Yeah, well, you know, we're mothers, so we know how important getting our young children that first step, that head start, you know, and they're going to be growing up in an age of AI, and so we've got to really be smart about how we lead
them. Oh, yeah. I remember, you know, we would always run into each other at some sporting event, yeah. And, you know, your son was doing stuff, my son was doing stuff. And then, you know, we feel for families that just because it shouldn't be an affordability question. If they want to send their kids to preschool, they want connection services, broadband services, it's our state obligation to ensure that, you know, quality of life for these people are heightened and increased, and that's our job.
Yeah, we've got to definitely close that digital divide across the state. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Lieutenant Governor. It's a pleasure to see you again, and don't wait but we'll see you soon.
No,
so come
back
again.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks again. We've been hearing from Lieutenant Governor Sylvia Luke. She's live in studio. She was giving us an update on the state's push to boost high-speed internet and preschool learning. Thank you.
Aloha. Join me, Nara Nellis, on After Hours, Hawaii Public Radio's new weeknight, late night music space, where each night brings a different host, sound, and point of view after dark. Every Monday, I host Electronic Soul, blending electronic, new disco, new age, and soul. Music to soundtrack your life, After Hours, Monday from 10 p.m. to midnight on HPR One.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. We are rolling in the dough, taking you back to the 1980s, a time when it seemed like decadent consumption was the norm. We take you out to Oahu's polo matches. This is where financial advisor Ron Riewoldt first caught the eye of Mokulea regulars by showing up with a different Rolls Royce or Excalibur each week. His new friends were even more dazzled when they learned he was a former NFL player. The smooth operator also shared that his investment company had a guaranteed minimum return of 20% annually. Soon, investors were lining up with their wallets open. In 1983, Riewoldt's promise of fat returns was exposed to be a Ponzi scheme, and his house of cards came tumbling down. He was tried and sentenced to 80 years in prison, but was released after serving only 10 years. For today's quiz, can you tell us the name of his fraudulent investment firm that incorporated the family names of well-respected Kama'aina? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. Pick up a reusable HBR tote bag if you're the first one to get it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
And earlier this month, the state's largest health insurer announced a major shakeup in Hawaii's healthcare landscape. HMSA proposed a deal with Hawaii Pacific Health that would create a new model similar to Kaiser Permanente's managed care system. HMSA and HPH maintain the move is necessary since healthcare systems across the state are losing money. The proposed partnership could have significant effects on Queens Health Systems. We sat down with CEO Jason Chang in our studio yesterday to better understand the dynamics of the proposed partnership and why he's resisting it. Chang starts off with a refresher on the history of Queens.
So back in 1859, Queens Hospital was opened. And the preceding maybe 10 years, Queen Emma and King Kamehameha IV were watching the death and devastation of the Native Hawaiian population. So they went to the legislature a few times and were denied funding to create this hospital. And Queen Emma, her father was a British physician, and so she had some introduction growing up in healthcare, or knowing that at least what healthcare was back in the 1850s was good for people. And it wasn't about surgery or medicine. It was about providing love and compassion and providing warmth and shelter and food. And so they went door to door. King Kamehameha IV and Queen Emma went door to door, fundraised $13,000, which created the seed money for that first hospital. And then over the course of 166 years, we've had really incredible visionary type of physicians and leaders that have turned it into what it is today. So today, the Queen's Health Systems is 6 hospitals. We are across most of Oahu. We have the hospital, Molokai General Hospital on Molokai. We have North Hawaii Community Hospital, and have announced a partnership to build a new hospital in Kona. That's a public-private partnership with the state. And now have almost 700 plus employed physicians and are the state's only Trauma One center. We're the only comprehensive stroke center. We're the busiest STEMI center if you have a heart attack. We have the transplant program, which we were able to salvage when St. Francis went bankrupt.
Yes.
And we're continuing to bring these advanced therapies. And so you think about the highest end technology in healthcare that we've provided, but we also take care of the most vulnerable patients in the state too. 85%+ of behavioral health patients come through our health system. We have the majority, over 65% of the homeless patients, and that's our mission. And we'll continue to provide for the patients that need us the most.
Yes, I mean, you know, you do meet the needs of our community in so many ways with the Kakela Ward, with Kahimohala, our young people, and those that are really sick, like you said, with transplants, that kind of thing. But, you know, I just go back to the Trauma One level standing at that hospital because we are watching our Honolulu grow with the high rises and just the number of people planned for the urban core. And it's just staggering when you think just what we had to deal with the fireworks explosion and what a strain that put on our hospitals, our burn units. And we had to fly people off because we just couldn't accommodate everyone.
That night, we had 50 trauma-related accidents that had jumped from all over. So the Ala Moana explosion happens, and 18 of those burn patients ended up at Queens, and 5 of them were critically injured. And 4 of them we actually had to send over to Arizona because the level of burn care that we provide was amazing. We learned, because we're not a burn center, but we learned that we have a number of physicians, surgeons, and nurses that had come from burn programs all around the nation. And so the ability for us to care for those patients was actually quite high. There were 4 that were so critically burnt that we needed to get them to a designated burn center, and that happened to be the one in Arizona. Tragically, one of them had passed due to the injuries, but pretty amazingly, there's the other 3 are making recoveries.
Well, that was top of mind for me just because we have these incidents where we just have to rally as a community, right? The healthcare community. And so when you see with this announcement with HMSA and Hawaii Pacific Health, it's like, okay, but then will there be unintended consequences? I get why they're looking at this model.
Yeah. I think what you hear is that we have to create a new system, that the system, and this is a national issue, the national healthcare system is not sustainable. And you look at the aging of our population, that there's going to be more healthcare needed. And that's not just unique to Hawaii. Hawaii has a very fragile healthcare system. And I think the challenge that you have here is that outside of Oahu, everything is pretty rural. It's hard to recruit nurses. It's hard to recruit physicians into places even like the Big Island. And when you think about this model that's being presented by HPH and HMSA, there are some intended and unintended consequences. I think the intended ones are that they hope, and this is a hope, that they are going to bend the cost curve, lower costs, but they're also going to improve access and improve quality. But we've looked at national models where they've been vertical integration of the payer and the healthcare provider. And in every single one of those instances, in fact, the congressional hearing last week focused on this very thing, it's never been able to drive the cost down and it's never been able to improve access. So when you think about Hawaii being that very fragile, delicate healthcare system that's just barely balancing at any given day, you're going to try this massive experiment that's going to toss around all the healthcare players and pray that it's going to come out okay. I think that because of those services that we had talked about, that Queens' sole providers, behavioral healthcare, trauma, transplant, stroke, some of the advanced cancer care that's the stuff that we only provide for the state of Hawaii. I call those critical services. And critical services require some of the other services like orthopedics, cardiology, neurology, oncology, which tend to have a decent margin with them. And you take these core services, and the profit that you make allows you to invest back in these critical services. And if you jeopardize this whole model, then all of a sudden these critical services may have to go away. So you think about hospitals. Wahiwa General Hospital is one that came into Queens. And over the course of their life, they used to deliver babies. They used to have a surgery program. They used to have a geriatric behavioral health program. They had a teaching. They used to rotate family practice doctors through and teach. And over time, those critical services got cut because of financial pressures. And when you think about on a much larger scale, if HMSA is starting to shift patients away from Queens and other healthcare providers, everyone's going to have to figure out, like, well, what are we going to live without? What can we not do and not jeopardize the healthcare and the access to that healthcare for everybody in Hawaii?
Well, you know, we have been hearing from Jason Chang, CEO of Queens Health Systems, and we will hear more right after a break.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
Join Hawaii Public Radio as we continue our Live from the Atherton concert series. We begin with Native Hawaiian artist Gregory Wan, singer, songwriter, and musician dedicated to perpetuating Hawaiian culture, Olelo Hawaii, and hula. Join us Saturday, February 7th. Tickets and details at hprtickets.org, sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from Zippy's, celebrating 60 years of serving the community local style foods and being a place where family and friends can meet and share bentos, saimin, or their own idea of island comfort meals.
Let's get back to our interview with Queens Health System CEO Jason Chang. We've been talking about the history of Queens, which was established by Queen Emma and is now our only Trauma One level hospital. Chang was talking about possible unintended consequences between a deal with HMSA and Hawaii Pacific Health, which was announced earlier this month. It's in the hands of regulators, but here's more from Chang. Getting back to the start of this conversation where you said this is a national issue, and we're worried for the state of our health care, then what's the solution? If HMSA is trying to come up with something, and they have with this tentative deal, what else can Queens suggest? How do we fix this?
Yeah, there's two narratives that are happening here. And so one of them is that HPH wants to create this new narrow network. But the other narrative is that HMSA has had financial challenges. They've lost money, that's public record, over the last several years to the tune of 100 plus millions of dollars a year. That is mostly from Medicare. So when you think about Medicare being the place that you're losing the most amount of money, how do you fix that? You need to go out and you need to manage that population better. So there really is overutilization of services, mismanagement of chronic disease, using the emergency department when you don't necessarily need to, or having to travel from far away places that doesn't have a healthcare service to Oahu. Those are all really expensive ways to take care of a person. So what needs to happen is managing that population better, which means geriatrics and primary care need to be involved. So what we're saying is the vertical integration is excluding everybody else that needs to help you solve this financial problem. So if you vertically integrate with HPH, there's about 200 providers that can manage the Medicare population. I have 200 primary care providers. I have another 40 geriatricians. And then the rest, the other 400 plus, are out there in the community as independents. And so by closing the door and saying that you guys are on this side of the fence and you can contract with us, it'll be an open network, but you have to play by our rules, makes us all a little suspicious about, okay, then why and how would we help this new entity? I think the reality is when you say, okay, we have to save the expense, the wasted expense in this model, that means that you're going to stop rendering care. You're going to have to compromise something. And what that actually is, we can't get answered. That's part of why we're trying to figure out, what does the model actually focus on? Who's not going to get care? What kind of care is not going to be covered anymore? Where's that waste? Because the $2 billion that they tout over the 10 years, that's a lot of money. And we can't figure out on our calculator, how do you actually get all the different numbers to add up to $2 billion?
Yeah, so you wonder about then the hidden price to pay that we don't know yet or see.
Yeah.
How that might affect your operation. And, you know, I know Queens has had a master plan. There's a build out of the campus there in town there on Punch Bowl. You've done a lot to, you know, expand the, I think, the emergency room, right? Because I know people who have gone down there and waited for a very long time because there are just so many people that need help. And I know there's been that effort to do the urgent care in more in the community so that you can get the people that are sick with the flu or whatever to go there and get the really critical care folks addressed immediately.
No, it's the sign of the times that as our population ages, there's more care that's needed. And then you also have people in the community, they're just not managing their chronic disease very well. So if you have diabetes or congestive heart failure, you wait until it's too late, and then you have to go to the emergency room. We've watched the number of people using our emergency room increase every year. I've been here 11 years, and it hasn't slowed down. We've never taken a step back, except for the COVID year. And that was because everyone stayed home, but they all came back and made up for it in the successive years. So we know that when people get sick or they get hurt, they're going to need care. What we're trying to do, and this is, I think, a universal challenge for all of us in healthcare in Hawaii, is how do we educate people to manage their chronic disease better? And we can use technology. So if there's a silver lining from COVID, that telemedicine all of a sudden became very real. And I think we can use technology like telemedicine, virtual care, remote patient monitoring to manage patients that live in rural communities and want to live in rural communities, but still be able to access care that they need. And that way we know earlier when they are starting to decompensate or something's getting worse, and then bring them in early when the cost of care is lower and we can actually get them back to health faster.
Yeah, it is daunting when you think about what could be riding on this deal and how the critical services that Queens offers in the community could stand to be affected.
Yeah. So there's a couple statistics that we went back into our finances and tried to understand, okay, what's being touted is that we're going to make people healthy. But there's really three books of business that make up all of healthcare. You have the Medicaid population, so we know who's on Quest here in Hawaii. You have the seniors, which is the Medicare population. That could be traditional Medicare, Medicare Advantage. And then you have commercial. And each one of those have very different needs and very different way that they're paid, that they're reimbursed. So no hospital or no provider really makes any money on Medicare or Medicaid. We struggle because those government payers just underpay, and this is a national phenomenon too. And again, those critical services are supported really by the commercial population. So the commercial population has a margin on it. And when you put the whole payer mix book of business together, it all balances out, and Queens, we're at break even, and we're happy to be there at break even. And hospitals around the nation have been struggling just to get to break even. So we know that there's a national challenge, and I think that's because we can't survive on the government payers. We rely on the commercial population, which is really the HMSA population. And that threat is that if 1% of our commercial population leaves Queens, it represents $9 million. So you might say, look, no big deal. We're just going to shift 5% of your commercial volume away. That's $45 million. And that's a lot of money and a lot of services that are being subsidized by this balanced payer mix. And in the world that's competitive, we say that as long as we're allowed to compete in a fair, open playing field, we'll recruit the best doctors, we'll provide the best services, we'll take care out to rural communities, and we'll compete for those patients. And those patients should have the right to pick where they want to go and get care. And if we are not providing a good product for the community, they absolutely have the right to say, okay, we're not going to get our care at Queens. And so that competition is really important. And when you vertically integrate, now all of a sudden you're saying, we have this new preferred network over here, and everyone else can either play by our rules, or you're not going to be part of this network. And that's part of that risk. And so you start moving commercial volume away, you don't have that extra revenue to support those critical services that we talked about.
Yeah, and then you talk about the doctors. I mean, just the shortage of healthcare workers in general.
Yeah.
And we're trying to work on that, but if you just don't have the doctors and the support staff, it's tough.
Yeah. The one thing I do worry about is that if you're an independent private practice community physician and they start to move away a little bit of your commercial volume because you're not willing to play by these new rules, you'll go bankrupt. You can't keep your practice alive. And so a lot of our legacy physicians in our community that many of you know and are taking care from, they're worried. And we want to be that voice. You know, I feel like Queens has to be that voice that at least advocates to our community and to our legislators and to the regulatory bodies who have to decide if this is good for Hawaii or not. Or is this too risky? Is it too much to do right now? That there's more implications. There's more people involved that are going to either go out of business or be impacted in some way that will definitely change, and maybe it's unintended, but will definitely change the healthcare landscape in Hawaii.
Yeah, it's a big gamble.
Big gamble.
All right, Jason, thank you so much for helping us to understand what's at stake here.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thank you for the opportunity.
That was Queen's CEO Jason Chang talking with us about their objections to the deal between HMSA and HPH. Full disclosure, HMSA and HPH are both underwriters of HPR. And now it's time for this week's Manu Minute. Today, we've got the call of the ban-rumped storm petrel. It's a bird cloaked in mystery because it only comes to land under the cloak of darkness. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
Akeake spend most of their lives on the open ocean, and like many seabirds, only come to land to breed. Historically, Akeake were abundant and widespread throughout the main Hawaiian islands, but the Hawaii population's now considered to be endangered. Because they're so rare and only come to land after dark, very little is known about them. After years of trying, the first nest of this species was finally found just a few years ago in a lava crevice at about 7,000 feet up the slopes of Mauna Loa volcano. One of the best ways to find them is to listen for their calls around their breeding colony at night. Akeake feed by pattering their small feet in the water and grabbing fish and squid from near the ocean's surface. They also frequently follow large predatory fish, which makes them valued by fisher people. Akeake only raise one nestling per season, and like other seabirds in Hawaii, are very susceptible to being eaten by feral cats when they're nesting. One of the best ways to protect Akeake colonies is by the construction of expensive predator-proof fenced areas where they breed. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail. Learn more about the Mauna Kea Summit and STARS Giveback experience, including a volunteering opportunity, at hawaii-forest.com.
You are invited to play trivia with HPR Generation Listen on the first Tuesday of the month at Village Bottle Shop and Tasting Room in Kaka'ako. Test your wits, enjoy some friendly competition, and meet with fellow HPR fans. Generation Listen is an HPR initiative that connects young and the young at heart listeners with the station and with each other. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org/genlisten.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors, Chaminade University, and Anchor Systems Hawaii.
Let's steal a moment to reveal today's backyard quiz answer. Remember Ronald Rewald? He's best remembered for running a Ponzi scheme in the 1980s that built local investors out of millions. As all good con men know, it's all about the front, and he impressed his clients with his fancy cars and lavish lifestyle, even a downtown office with a working waterfall, and he had a National Football League affiliation. He displayed an NFL promotional photograph of himself in uniform, football in hand, a doctored shot in which his head was clumsily grafted onto the body of a real pro football player. After he was arrested, he claimed that his business was really a money laundering front for the CIA. ABC News ran a two-part story about his claim. Everything got sorted out eventually, and Ron Rewald was released after serving a 10-year prison sentence in federal prison, although he initially was sentenced to 80 years. If you ever find the letterhead with the moniker Bishop Baldwin Rewald Dillingham and Wong, you may have a collectible on your hands. That was the masthead of his bogus firm and today's answer. Congrats to our winner, Jeff Walker from Kona on the Big Island. You got it right. If you have an idea for a quiz to share, send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. You know, the British Museum has a collection of some 9 million artifacts, which makes it one of the largest in the world. This month, it debuted a new exhibit titled Hawaii, A Kingdom Crossing Oceans. It also released a catalog of nearly 1,000 pieces from the islands. 150 of those items are part of a show that runs in London at the British Museum through May. HPR was there for the opening protocols and opening reception 2 weeks ago. The carving of the Hawaiian god Ku stood prominently at the gallery entrance. Museum Director Nicholas Cullinan welcomed the large crowd. Officials said it was one of the largest openings for the museum. It marked 202 years since a voyage of King Kamehameha II and his queen would reach across the sea, nation to nation. The couple died of measles on their visit, a tragic end to the voyage, but the connections made centuries ago continued to be strengthened.
Tonight, as we open our remarkable new exhibition, Hawaii, the Kingdom Crossing Oceans, I would like to give a special welcome to our friends and colleagues who have traveled a long way from Hawaii to be with us this evening. It's a great privilege to have you here and to have worked with so many of you to shape this powerful exhibition. We also express our gratitude to community members from across the Pacific who have made a home here in the UK and have gathered here for this reception. Your collective presence honors us and guides us as the British Museum is committed to working with all of you for many years to come. This place, too, is your home. Tonight, we commemorate a story that spans vast distances and connects two island nations. It's a story of navigation, diplomacy, and cultural exchange that began over 200 years ago and continues to this very day.
Noel Kahanu is one of the members of the stewardship committee who helped to guide the museum in its presentation of Hawaii's cultural treasures, our Nameo Kapuna. Kahanu explained why this point in time is so significant with the museum's collaboration between collections and community.
Aloha. Eia Hawaii, he moku, he kanaka Hawaii, ye, he kanaka Hawaii, he kama akahiki. These are the opening lines of a much longer chant that tells of the arrival of a chief and his contingent upon Hawaii's shores. It is the chant that greets you at the entrance to the exhibition Hawaii, a Kingdom Crossing Oceans. It is as though you have arrived onto our shores, and what unfolds is a Hawaii you will experience for the very first time. Indeed, the opening text panel profoundly declares that Hawaii is a Pacific Island nation unified into a kingdom in 1810. Is a Pacific Island nation, not was. Present tense. How is it that dozens of us travel to your distant land, 11,000 kilometers from our home, to have an exhibition recognize our enduring sovereignty, something that escapes many who occupy our lands to this day? This is what brought our King Liholiho, Queen Kamamalu, and their delegation to London 202 years ago, the possibility of a British protectorate that would ensure the continued sovereignty of a rising nation. But it also reflected a Hawaiian desire to reach beyond our known horizons, expand our knowledge, engage on an international political stage, and project our mana out into the world. That this trip ended in tragedy does not diminish his intentions, his desires, and the legacy of his journey, which continues to unfold. The exhibition is not just about Hawaii, but one that reflects the ongoing relationship between our nations. Though it is called Hawaii, a Kingdom Crossing Oceans, in truth, there were many a nation that came calling to Hawaii's shores, that sought our resources and pursued relationships with our chiefs over repeated visitations, and none more so than the United Kingdom. And so now we stand here not only as a result of our own interests, but of yours. The Hawaiian collection assembled within the British Museum is both a testament to this centuries-long relationship and a reflection on its complexities. Found upstairs will be well over 100 mea kupuna, ancestral treasures, many of which have rarely been on display. It is but a fraction of the 950 items within the Hawaiian collection, the vast majority of which often remain in darkness, a matter that is exacerbated by the lack of a permanent Pacific exhibition space. And yet, for the very first time, in the accompanying exhibition catalog, this inventory has been reproduced in its entirety, with photos, details, and provenance information, a huge and extraordinary feat that will become an important and profound resource for our community. This exhibition and its accompanying catalog will enable those mea kupuna to finally experience the light of day, to tell their story, to be revered and remembered, honored, and celebrated. We hear their kahea, stories of love and loss, connection and separation, and they in turn hear our uwe, our cry. We hear and carry on in their artistic cultural legacies and the practices of our ancestors,
We embody their sovereign aspirations, and we seek to build upon and foster deeper relationships that our chiefs began. We embrace the ohana of our broader Moana Nui Akea and those who persist and hold space in this distant place. And we especially aloha those within these walls who care for and steward these collections.
And finally, we hear from a Big Island student completing his studies in Great Britain. We first met Travis Chai Andrade when we featured the 2025 Marshall Scholar on The Conversation last year. The scholarship program was set up by Great Britain in gratitude to the U.S. for its alliance during wartime. Chai Andrade has the opportunity to complete his advanced degrees in the U.K. over a three-year period. He worked as a volunteer on the exhibit, helping curators Elise Christoph and Frey Crabtree, and he says he felt humbled by the experience at this point in his academic career.
I think it's beyond anything that I expected to be part of coming to the UK. I know that coming here, we have so many of our mea kupuna, and things are just in this country because of different historical circumstances. But to see them all on display and to be part of that process of seeing them installed, of being part of their coming out of the storerooms and being brought into the light is such an incredible process. And I think seeing the individual mea kupuna go up, it didn't really hit me until the opening on Monday night when Noelle was giving her speech and just really taking in that this is such a huge moment, not just for Hawaii, but I think for the future of exhibitions and the possibilities of collaboration and just highlighting the rich connections that Hawaii has had around the world. But so many different indigenous peoples have these kinds of connections with different people. And I think it's a testament to who we were and a testament to Elise and Freya and the British Museum trying to take things in a new direction.
And was there any particular favorite that you had in what was showcased?
Everything in there is just incredible. I think the thing that drew me to museums was Ku. I first saw Ku at the Peabody Essex Museum, actually. And I was just enamored with sort of like the grandeur and significance of him being around the world. And so I was originally going to write my thesis on that. And so I came to the British Museum a few years ago and I saw him in the storeroom. But to see him front and center, you know, one of the first things you see walking into the British Museum is beyond incredible. And everything in there is truly amazing.
And very early at around 7 tomorrow morning, curator Alice Christoph will hold a webinar about the exhibit. Registration is required, and we'll have details on our website later today. The talk will also be available by subscribing to the British Museum YouTube channel. And this spring, students from Kamehameha schools will travel to London to experience the exhibition. We'll have more on that tomorrow. Well, we have to go now, but up tomorrow, we plan to take you inside the ring. We highlight an amateur boxing festival. Got feedback for us? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find The Conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.